shucking jive.
All you racing fans, stand up, clap your feet. I mean, clap your heads.
Welcome to the Goat Rodeo.
Live from the CRN studios in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, this is
Hello Race Fans. Welcome to this edition of the Goat Rodeo. My name is Jeff Gilder. We're just tickled to death that you're here with us. Let's get around and say hello to everybody that's here. Starting out in Dawsonville, Georgia, say hello to Cody Densmore. Say hello to Cody, Cody.
Say hello to Cody.
Yeah, there you go. How's that? That worked, didn't it?
Well, I'm off instructions, right?
How are things out in Dawsonville today?
Well, they're real good. You know, we're finally getting relieved of our sweltering summer heat. So it's been a good couple of days, nice and cool.
Fall is in the
refreshing.
Air.
Well, I hope so. I love the fall.
I do too, man. The fall in Dawsonville is really pretty too.
Yeah, we have orange and red and yellow trees and moonshine festivals and cool air and, you know, all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah, that's good, man. That's good. That's good stuff. How about you, Tim, out there in the lair? How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, thank you. We're not having anything but a little bit of it. It went from 100 down to about 79 today. And we had a little misty rain, but other than that, we don't have fall yet, but it's coming.
From 100 to 79, you probably had to put on a sweater, didn't you?
I know, man. I had on sweatpants and big, thick wool socks and a sweatshirt and a sweater and a hoodie and everything else.
All right. Well, let's say hello to the fellas in the studio tonight. We're missing one Coastal Jack Walker, but I do have the bopper and the man on the street in here. Say hello, Hewlin. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I'm all rested from our week off, and I've been up to the mountains of North Carolina this past weekend, so I'm good.
I'm tired of hearing about your travels, man.
Hey. and where are you fixing to go? you won't talk about it on the air.
Yeah, I might. Bopper, how you doing, sir?
Hey, doing good. Doing good. Survived Tropical Depression TD-195/L.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just barely.
Yeah. So but, what's the next one going to be? M or something.
I don't know where this new where this new nomenclature come from, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I don't know either, man. It's weird.
It's complicated.
Before we get started, somebody tell me what's going on with Jack.
Jack Walker?
Yeah.
He's still in Camden.
He's remodeling his house.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was worried about that eye operation because I got mine scheduled today.
Oh, I just had one. I can tell you all about it.
Cool. Go ahead, Bobby.
All right, you can't. All right.
Have you had it yet, or are you going to have it?
I'm going to have it November 1st and November 15th.
Okay. It takes about 20 minutes, but it takes a lot of gearing up and red tape.
Yeah.
A ton of that. The procedure is nothing but the red tape will kill you.
So what'd you have done, Bobby? Cataract.
Cataract. 2 weeks ago tomorrow.
Did it help?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Man, I don't even wear glasses anymore.
Got no glasses on.
Have 20/20 vision. Easy 20/20.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I've wore glasses for 42 years.
And removing the cataracts fixed it?
Well, that and I had astigmatism, and so they put in a lens that done both cataract-free and astigmatism correction.
So they replaced the lens in your eye?
That's what cataract.
Is that what cataract surgery is? Yeah.
They replaced the lens.
Yeah, how about that? Wow.
It is unreal. It had been science fiction a few years
ago. Where did they get that lens?
Lens R Us.
I've been trying to talk.
Off some dead fella?
Blue lens.
But, yeah, it's really nothing itself, Tim. The procedure is about 20 minutes long.
Huh.
I've had both of mine done, and they used the first time they used a weird anesthesia where I was not really knocked out. I was aware, I was kind of conscious, but you just don't care.
I like that kind of consciousness.
Yeah, you just don't care.
I thought that's what the last did.
I think it knocked me out.
The other time they knocked you completely out.
Yeah, the second time they knocked. I asked them about that. They said, we're going to use a different kind this time. You probably ain't going to remember it.
But that's what I want.
The first time I remember, you were aware, I was aware.
So before we get started, let everybody know my schedule is changing drastically for the rest of the year. Going to miss some shows, and nothing I can do about it. I'm going to be out of town quite a bit between now and the end of the year. Not exactly sure what all the dates are right now. I can tell you two: the first week of October and November 16th through the 26th. But there'll be some other weeks in there too. As soon as I get it scheduled, I'll try to let folks know. But we're going to be missing some time. But there's nothing I can do about it except sit here and not make any money, so I got to go make money. But anyway, got that out of the way. Let's talk about racing. Who's up?
Who's up?
Bob.
Well, we got the and Tim can help us out a lot on this because I know he's going. The Southern 500 is coming up.
Yeah.
This weekend. Now, Tim, is it Saturday night or Sunday night?
Sunday night.
It's the Bojangles Southern 500, isn't it?
The Bojangles Southern 500. I think the Xfinity race is Saturday night or either Saturday afternoon. I'm not sure. But yeah. I think the race Sunday starts at 6 o'clock. At least that's what our tickets say. So
those people got some good chicken biscuits, man.
Talked to Johnny Allen about 20 minutes ago, and he's going down. So, you know, there'll be a lot of the old people, older drivers that ran and made Darlington exciting will be there.
Cool.
Yeah, and then there's going to be all the old retro paint schemes, or, you know, a lot of the cars will have those. So.
Yeah, well, they supposedly, somebody told me they are retroing or concentrating the retro on 1985. So I've got a Winston Million cap that I'm going to wear along with my Winston Racing T-shirt. So, you know, we're going retro ourselves here.
Where are your seats, Tim, on the new front stretch?
They're on the new front stretch, 14 rows up, one section down from start-finish line.
Good seats.
How do you know?
I tell you, I think this throwback weekend is just the best thing to happen to NASCAR in years.
I do too.
Yeah, and so appropriate.
The last couple of years have been so exciting, and you know, unfortunately, I haven't been able to watch both of them live on TV. But I mean, that's one time where I will watch every lap of the recording, flag to flag, because it's just so interesting to me. I think they do just a great job with the broadcast, and they bring in Ken Squire and Ned Jarrett. You know, just all of a good throwback feel. So I love it, and I'd love to go one day.
Yeah,
I think it's going to be fun for me. I have not been since I took the grandsons to the 2011 600 in Charlotte. So that was my last race that I went to.
Now, when are you going to arrive at the track, Tim? What is your plans on that?
Probably. With the two friends and I have been talking about it, we're probably going to leave Columbia about 2 o'clock, so we should be there parked in place by 4 at the latest. It takes, driving over there without the traffic, it takes me about an hour and 10 minutes to get to the track. So I imagine with the traffic, allowing for traffic, we should be there in 2 hours. Are you going, Bopper?
Not that I know of. I haven't made any arrangements at this time, although it would be cool to go. When I used to go as a kid, that's where we set. That was the old backstretch,
right?
And you may remember they had those manufacturers' boxes on very top of the open grandstand. They had those manufacturers' boxes, and there was two layers of them. And we always would sit in those box seats, which was pretty good view. Even from there, you couldn't see a lot of the front stretch.
Well, I remember sitting in the infield all those years looking up at those boxes and trying to decide whether or not I'd have the guts to climb the stairs to get up there.
Well, that they were really elevated, but...
Oh, I know.
And it wasn't for lack of elevation that you couldn't see. It was for all of the stuff that was in the infield. There was various buildings and scoring pylons and this, that, and the other. And just the way it all was, you just literally couldn't see. You couldn't see the front stretch hardly. You could see the tops of the cars. And actually, you couldn't see the back stretch either. You could only see the tops of the cars. Because, you know, at Darlington, the Fastway was right up against the wall.
Right.
So all you could really see from those box seats was the first and second turn.
Well, I went over to, how many years ago, back in the 90s, they ran the Goodies Dash race over the Arrow 1. And I sat almost in the exact place where we'll be sitting Sunday. And it was an excellent view. We had, we could see all the way through 1 and 2, 3 and 4, right down in front of us. And even catch them coming off what was then, I think, turn 4 heading down. I don't know how to describe it. When did they change it? When did they flip the track?
Late 80s, early 90s, wasn't it?
Later than that.
Yeah, it was later than that. Was it? But I'm not sure when it was.
I'm not either, but that's it. It is just funny that that's where we sat. You know, that's where we sat over there. So I don't know. But I'm looking forward to it. I hope the weather's going to cooperate. The weatherman's forecast tonight, Alex, please help. But the forecast tonight was just like, you know, throwing darts at the wall, which most weather forecasts around here are. All right, Alex said they flipped it in 97. So that would have been after the Goodies Dash race I attended.
To me, the best seats in the house were about halfway up the grandstands on what is now the front stretch, all the way down toward turn 4, where you can watch them come through 3 and 4 and watch them come out to the wall and pick up their Darlington stripe out of 4 going down the front stretch. It's that track more than any other to me really shows how to do a power drift on asphalt because they're really doing it. And it shows you how much skill those guys have to do that lap after lap after lap and not hit the wall, because you just throw it into the corner and let it drift until it stops. And the idea is that it stops just a fraction of an inch before you touch the wall. Sometimes they misjudge it a little.
That was the fastest way around.
Yep.
Back in the day, if you didn't get a Darlington stripe,
you weren't running. You weren't running fast enough to win the race.
Yeah.
So what happened this past weekend?
There was not a cup race.
No, but there was one of the most exciting Xfinity races that have ever been in the history of NASCAR.
Tell us about it, Tim.
Well, I think what impressed me more than anything else, you know, and I'll just go into, can I go into my whole little segment right now?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, first of all, let's start off with the fact that today would have been Wendell Scott's, I believe, 98th birthday. And there were so many times that I would help Wendell Scott and his two sons push their car to the starting line. A couple of times at Atlanta, all the time at Columbia Speedway, and a couple of times at Darlington. And Wendell was always, to me, he was a great guy to be around. He was so humble. He was a great driver. But what really brought him to mind with the birthday thing was I remember how hard Wendell worked on his race car. And I was sitting in the grandstands at Augusta Raceway, I think it was, probably 1964, I believe it was. And Wendell came in the pits. He had a flat tire coming off of turn 2, and his pits were on the back straightaway. And he came flying into the pit road, and he jumped out of the car himself and helped his sons change that flat tire. And then he got back in the car and took off again. But he did a lot of that work. all on his own, and he was probably, if not the hardest working independent race driver on the circuit. He was very, very close to being that.
And you've been corrected. His 96th birthday, according to Alex.
Well, that's fine. If Alex, you know, that's good because his memory is a lot better than mine. His knowledge is a lot better than mine. But so anyway, Wendell Scott, as I thought about what an independent did, when I was growing up, they were down at the bottom of the hill on the main highway from our little neighborhood down the country. There was a pure oil station on one side and an Esso station on the other side. And as we have talked about so many times, every little gas station had a race car. The pure oil station had a race car that the guy drove at Columbia Speedway. I'm not really sure where the guy drove the Esso, but they were independents, and my Uncle Bobby used to take me down to the pure oil gas station with him a lot of times just to sit around and watch them work on the race car. And I learned pretty much, let's just say my vocabulary was well prepared for my naval service by the time I got to the Navy from listening to these guys work on the race car. But I think watching that race Sunday, you know, Jeremy Clemens had started 256 races and had never won in the Xfinity Series. And he has a little father and uncle, I think, run team out of Spartanburg, South Carolina. Very independent. Not a whole lot of backing. I mean, he had sponsors on that car like you would think were on the cars of the late model sportsman series back in the 60s and 70s. And he won that race on that road course, on that 4-mile road course on Sunday. Of course, it was a spin. He and the leader of the race, he got into him a little bit coming off the last turn of the last lap. And they both spun, but Jeremy got his car straightened out, and he went on to win. And the celebration that happened on pit road with his crew, on the track when his crew got out there, and in victory lane, took me back to the time when racing was really racing, and an independent guy had a chance to go out there and run his little independent car built in the little family shop and win a race. And that made me feel really good for Jeremy Clements, for the Xfinity Series, and for every. And I normally don't watch, because if Kyle Busch is in it, I turn it off. I do not watch it. But I'm glad I watched that one, because it was so great to see Jeremy Clements win that race. And then all the social media buzz that has happened for him since Sunday can't do anything but rise his stock in NASCAR racing. You know, sure, it's one win out of 256 starts, but he really showed he had to be there. It was a tough race all the way through. It was a tough race, banging and slamming and sliding into the gravel pits and by a lot of drivers. But all these guys that were out there running were running Xfinity cars. Now, of course, JGR had their junk in there, and it was the JGR car that Jeremy spun to take the lead. But still, you know, to me, that was just going back to the time when racing was really racing. A good kid won with a good team, a family team, a mom and pop team, as they say. And I was real proud for Jeremy Clements, and I look forward to seeing him go, really go. I mean, his confidence has got to be boosted now, and he was one happy man. But when you think about Wendell Scott and Hal Howard, he worked as an independent, and you see Jeremy Clements, you know, in all these span of years between the two of them, you can certainly hit a correlation between what those two guys did in racing. So, you know, if Jeremy never wins another race, Wendell won one time too at Jacksonville in 63. So I thought it was a great race, and that's the report from the lair today.
Well, the Clements family has a long history in racing.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
Was his uncle, was it his uncle or great uncle that was Rex White's crew chief?
I'm thinking probably great uncle, but I'm not sure. I am not sure. And as Alex said just now, it's more impressive is that Clements straight up won that race. Yes, he did. He flat out straight up outdrove everybody else on the track, and he did do a fantastic job winning that race. And I am so proud of him. Made me bust my buttons watching him do that.
It's
cold here.
I read on some of the social media comments, Tim, that their car is a 9-year-old, basically homemade chassis.
It is. Yeah. He said that. He said that in the post race interview. 2008 chassis.
You know, so, he had an accident several years ago too, and his hand was almost severed. Drive shaft came through the floorboard and almost cut his hand off.
Yeah. I mean, it was just so much about that race that made it so special, so special to see him win it, and all the comments. I have not seen one negative comment on social media. Have you, Bopper?
No, I have not.
Of course,
not.
I don't think Joe Gibbs actually gets on social media, so that's probably why. But, you know, it was just a great win.
It's always pleasant to see the little guy triumph. It happens today so seldom that it always makes me feel good. I was not where I could watch the race, and I'm sorry I missed it. But I've heard enough about it this week to really be tickled for him and his crew to stick it to the man, so to speak. The little guy, the
Such
independent, needs a win once in a while. It's a shame that there aren't, that the circumstances are such that there are so few independents that they just can't make it, and it's a shame. Hopefully, we may see some more independents and small teams come back into the picture beginning next year.
Cody, what you got for us tonight?
But you know, I had a discussion going on with a lady on social media a few weeks ago when I said something about the fact that, when Kyle Busch comes into Xfinity with this multi-million-dollar team, how is that fair? And she came back to tell me he doesn't have a multi-million-dollar team. He's just driving a straight Toyota. And I said to her, ma'am, excuse me, is that not a JGR Toyota that he's driving? I mean, you know, JGR's got about 40 teams he owns. But anyway, I see where Joe Gibbs did back off the fact that he's released the Furniture Row teams. Now he's claiming no more control over their pit crews.
All right, Cody, what do you got for us tonight, buddy?
Well, y'all kind of touched on it a little bit there. The best thing I thought I could talk about relating to Jeremy Clement, which, you know, I just thought that was so cool, because I've been following him on social media and stuff for the last 3 or 4 years. And just seems like a really, blue-collar kind of, racer trying to make a name for himself. And I really like following the Xfinity series because of that and the little guys that can. So, with his uncle, great-uncle, uncle, whatever he was, being Louis Clements and Rex White, our buddy, I thought I'd talk a little about Rex White.
There you go.
So I'm just going to skim over a little article I found real quick. Basically, I'll start with Rex started racing in NASCAR in 1956 when the Grand National Division. He started 24 races and finished in the top 10 14 times, as well as finishing second in the final short track standings, lower down Grand Nationals. In 1958, he moved to Spartanburg in order to join forces with Clements, his friend, his partner, and chief mechanic. They proceeded to build their first late model Chevy and competing with the NASCAR circuit. They met a year or so earlier when both were working on Chevy's factory racing team, which would be the Black Widow cars. And it says that Chevy dropped out of racing in June of 1957. So that's when a lot of the Chevy teams dropped out. And so, Rex always drove Chevy cars. I'm going to skip down to Watt's first and only championship came in 1960, and his first win of the season occurred in the ninth event of the season. Through the remainder of the season, White won six more of his 28 career victories. He finished outside the top 10 in finishing position only five times throughout the 40 starts of the 1960 season, and he won the championship, which I think is really amazing. By the end of the 1960 season, he also earned the Most Popular Driver Award and the Driver of the Year Award. His gold and white 1960 Chevrolet secured his first championship just prior to the season-ending Atlanta 500-mile race. His championship hopes improved dramatically during the inaugural World 600, while a lot of people were disqualified for not making a proper entrance to pit lane. Also, the race where, I believe, the asphalt kept flying up because it wasn't cured right or something. So Rex finished sixth in that first 600-mile event, and he earned $13,000 for winning the championship that year. In 1961, White won 7 races and finished second in the points. He competed in a total of 47 of the 55 events that year, and he recorded 29 top fives and a career-best 39 top 10 finishes. He competed in 37 events in 1962, winning a career-best 8 wins, and finished the season 5th in points. And what he claims is his greatest accomplishment was to win the Dixie 500 or Dixie 400 race, rather, 1962 at Atlanta, which was, his home track, at least now anyway. He claims that's his best overall win. And if I can find it, it mentioned somewhere in this article that he had one of the best average finishing, I guess you want to call it that. Here it is. It says that his average finish from 1956 to 1964 was 9th. An average start was 8.1, and his average finish was 9th. So I think that's pretty amazing. You know, he started 233
races.
Cody,
did you know that between 1960 and 1962, he won 28 races, which is more races than anybody else during that period of time? Harbaugh, Roberts, Lee Petty, Richard Petty, any of them won.
And you know, it's a shame that not a lot of people know that. And, I just finding he finished in the top 10 163 times out of 233 races. That's, 70% of the time he finished in the top 10. Now, given there wasn't as many drivers in the field, but still he had more races, maybe a little bit tougher competition. But Rex is just an incredible guy, and I'm glad that he's finally getting some of the limelight that he deserves from the NASCAR Hall of Fame, from different organizations around the South, different racing groups and museums and Hall of Fames are finally bringing his name back to recognition. So I just thought I would mention a little bit of all of our buddy Rex White's accomplishments through the help of Louis Clements. So,
and
can I mention one thing there, Cody?
And Louis Clements was Jeremy's uncle.
Right.
I just found it. Not great uncle. I thought it was great uncle. It was uncle. His grandfather was Crawford Clements. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that on September 16th at the AIRPS event, they're going to dedicate the Rex White Memorial Motorsports Plaza there at Diamond Lakes in Augusta, Georgia, or actually Hepzibah, but they're in Augusta, and Rex is going to be there. Eddie Sperlin, Bobby Allison, Donnie Allison, and a host of drivers from Georgia area will be there for that dedication.
Cool. All right, Bopper, you're up, buddy.
Well, since it's Darlington Week, I want to touch on, get back to that a little bit. That's a biggie to me. I mean, we've talked about this many times, and we've had Harold Brasington III in here a couple of times, and we've enumerated the fact that what Mr. Brasington done, maybe inadvertently to an extent, but nevertheless what he done set the wheels in motion for what is NASCAR.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, NASCAR was just yet another sanctioning body racing, you know, on a small scale.
That's what Big Bill said, right? That was the future of NASCAR.
And that vision was not Big Bill's. He was among the first to recognize the potential, but it wasn't his vision. It was Mr. Brasington. who's really and truly set the and it wasn't even his vehicle. I mean, he was trying to make an Indy car track and race and so on and so forth. He had been to the Indianapolis 500 earlier in his life, and I was extremely impressed, and came home and tried to replicate that in his hometown, which just happened to be Darlington, South Carolina. It's just a lot of just coincidences just happened. But he was evidently such a salesman that he talked enough people into sponsoring the dream, and it literally came true. But along the way, the open wheel championship car part did not work out, and stock cars was added kind of as a last ditch effort to salvage something, and even that didn't work out because he had his original goal was the Central States Stock Car Association, as best I remember, and as the race date approached, they had virtually no one pre-entered. Because remember, this was still what they were going to do, a 500-mile strictly stock race on a super speedway, was still a totally unproven concept. Nobody knew if it would work or not. Most people thought no car can last 500 miles. And then the drivers, they were, in addition to being concerned about that, they had no faith in the sanctioning body to actually pay the money. So they won was... as a last-ditch effort, Mr. Brazen got Bill France, who had clout with the drivers. And once he came on board, then the drivers did too. And, of course, the rest is literally history, big history. But that started NASCAR. There's no question. There is zero question that Darlington and the super speedway phenomena, that's what set it apart from everything else. That done it. A part of the story that we've talked about a lot is, and even with Harold III, and then this is the murky part, is how did Mr. Brazington lose out so quickly? And then that's, we've never got a good explanation on that part. That's the sad part to me. That I think by 1952 or 51, it was almost no time. He was out. I don't. Obviously, some wires got crossed, and when one makes a corporation, it might have been your idea and everything to start with. But if you sell shares in it and enough other people own them, then it ain't yours no more. Yep. You know, that is the reality of how corporations work, and that one brought that to bear. Pretty early on in Darlington, but even with all of that going on, it's history was, I mean, it was a snowball downhill. It just got bigger and bigger and bigger, and they kept building stands because they could sell all the seats they could build, you know. In the early days, there was a pedestrian bridge over the backstretch. I've only seen pictures of it, but there was a, I think that might have been before there were stands on the backstretch, there was a pedestrian bridge, which was a didn't last a whole long, very long, but lots of things happened over the years. The track was slightly redesigned from 1.25 miles to 1.366. I've never understood exactly how that figure came about. How do you decide to? Are we going to enlarge it to 1.366 miles instead of a mile and a quarter?
But didn't that come about when the NASCAR finally decided to standardize the way they measured the tracks?
Actually, I think there was some physical redesign work and some actual construction went on that changed that also. Of course, everybody knows the story of the egg shape was because of the pond.
Yeah.
They had the...
what's his name? Menapond.
Ramsey. Yeah,
Mr. Ramsey.
Yeah.
Who actually Menapond. Owned the site. It was his property. He put up the property as his share of stock. And the only condition was you couldn't affect the pond, which they didn't. And I guess it's still there, ain't it, Tim? Is the minute, or is it?
It was still there. When I took a tour over to the museum about 2 years ago, yeah, it was still there.
The last I ever knew, it was still there. But anyway, my hometown, Charlotte, North Carolina, is about 100 miles from Darlington. And from day one, from the moment it ever started, it was a big deal in my hometown, and everybody in the world would go. And it got to be a bigger and bigger social occasion every year. More and more people, I mean, that became a community reunion, if you will. Everybody would go to Darlington, and everybody would camp out, and it got to be not a contest, but a
rite
part
of passage.
Of the drama. Yeah, rite of passage, and what kind of camping rig you was going to construct once you got there. That became a real part of it, because nobody rarely used whatever they used the last year. The camping, they would try to improve it for the next year. So that just became a part of our social fabric from back in the 50s. My community, I think my dad went to the very first one, but we had from a community, I can never not remember knowing about Darlington. I remember as a kid knowing. I didn't make the connection of Labor Day and all of that, but I knew ever so often that everybody went to Darlington.
And before the race, that's all they could talk about. And after the race, they replayed it and replayed it and replayed it like a Friday night football game for years.
Replayed what?
The race.
Talked about it. Then in later years, the Rebel race came along in the spring, and it never had the impact. I mean, it was at its height, it was pretty well attended, but it was never, the same thing as the Southern 500.
Yep. That was always, well, for many, many years, that seemed to be the crown jewel in the NASCAR repertoire, I guess, until they built Daytona.
Darlington had a 9-year run as the only super speedway.
Yeah.
From 1950 to 59, it was and you read stories today about how iconic and crude and rough and everything that Darlington is, but that's only true in light of comparison of the stuff that was built
after that.
When Darlington was built, it was state of the art. It was, I mean, there was no, it had no comparison and no other, unless you consider Indianapolis.
And that was not in our part of the country and not in the NASCAR realm of racing cars. So it just didn't count.
It was not crude. At the time of its construction, it was outer space. It took almost 10 years before anything else come along, and that was Daytona. And, of course, Bill France had lots of time to look at Darlington, study it, think about it,
right.
plan, try to correct on the mistakes and all that. So he had almost a 10-year span there to improve on it. And in a large degree, he did improve on it. And then, all the rest of them came and so on and so forth.
But you think of what Darlington was then, and the only comparison we had in the South was the Saturday night dirt tracks. Pretty much, there might have been a few paved ovals around, but almost all of them were dirt. So when you compared Darlington in its infancy with what was around the southern part of the country, it was, you're right, completely state-of-the-art.
That was, I never knew of another paved track for a long time until... I don't think any of the for a long time it was the only paved race on the NASCAR circuit. That's kind of hard to believe.
I don't know when they started racing at Bowman Gray. It was a paved flat quarter mile, and there's just no comparison. But it was paved from day one, and it goes back into the late 40s. I'm not sure about the Alex can tell us when they started the first NASCAR race at Bowman Gray. But Bowman Gray is just, it was around a football field, and it was really a football stadium that they just added a track to. There was certainly no comparison between those two tracks, but it was the only other paved one that I knew anything about.
I remember.
Do they still play football up there, Hugh?
I don't think so.
No, they do.
Who plays?
I think it's Winston-Salem State.
I think they have abandoned it now. They took possession of the track with a long-time lease for the racetrack, but they took possession of the stadium. But I think since then, they have built themselves a new stadium.
Huh. I thought they were still playing.
And they ran Reynolds High School away from there some years back. They had to go someplace else to play football. And I think now that they have decided it's too antiquated for them and they don't play there anymore. But I think Western Salem State was the last ones to play. Alex is typing something. We'll find out.
NASCAR is sanctioned Bowman Gray since 1947, right, when NASCAR was still the NCSCC.
There you go.
Well, it technically might be the longest paved track in NASCAR, but it had nowhere near the star power.
No, it was still just a local track. You just didn't hear of many people coming from very far away to attend a race at Bowman Gray. Although the locals have faithfully attended it from day one. NASCAR has sanctioned Bowman Gray since 1947. That's phenomenal in itself, but that's a whole other subject.
Wikipedia says it's still the home of the Winston-Salem State University Rams.
Well, maybe they are still playing. I understood that they had built their own stadium, but maybe not.
I got to thinking today, and it would have been 53 years ago right now, this very week, Darlington was coming up. That would be 1964. And on the local scene, dirt tracks around this area was popping up like crazy in 1964. They were just going everywhere, and dirt racing was getting a very local flavor to it. There had been tracks here before. Ramby Raceway, for example, which is now Myrtle Beach, had been there since the 50s. But it was already sufficiently sophisticated that the locals really couldn't participate. It was NASCAR modifieds and so on, and that was really upscale. But local racing got off on a big way in 1964 on a very local, weekly, everybody can get in it kind of thing, and lots of people did, including my dad. And we looked all summer. I didn't really know what we were looking for, but we went to a lot of junkyards. First of all, looking for Hudsons. We literally looked for Hudson Hornets, and there was still some to be had in junkyards in 1964. And finally, we found several of them. And finally, at the last minute, the search shifted from a Hudson Hornet to a 55 Chevrolet.
Woohoo!
And we bought one off of a used car lot with a blowed-up motor. Worked on her for about 2 weeks. And it was going to be a race car, and it was. And the first race my father was going to enter and ever drove in was the Sunday before Labor Day, which would be on Monday of 1964. And it was at the old Carolina Beach Speedway in Wilmington. And Dad went over there and raced and everything, and in the field with him that day was Hoss Ellington and Richard Brickhouse and Jackie Rogers. And in the pits was Runt Pittman. And all those guys was racing the worst track that's ever been in the world was Carolina Beach Speedway. But my dad was there. And because of all of that, he missed camping out at Darlington in 1964 because he was racing his own self. So we went to Darlington. I didn't get to camp out either that time. We just got up early Labor Day Monday morning and went to Dart, just drove that day, which was very much atypical for us because the whole deal was to get the camp out and all of that. So we missed it. But anyway, that was my first trip to the Southern 500, and Buck Baker won. You remember that, Tim?
In a Dodge.
In a Gray Fox Dodge. Nobody thought. Of course, I was 10 years old. I didn't know all this drama was going on. I was just wide-eyed and just looking at everything. But looking back on it now, it was his third Southern 500.
That's right.
And he
won,
was like,
one of them on three wheels.
He was like three tires, 47 years old, I think. And it was kind of a one-race deal, and nobody thought he was going to do nothing except maybe Ray Fox. And he won the race. Yeah.
He won the race.
I remember in that race, little Bud Moore, Junior Johnson spun out, coming out the second turn, and little Bud Moore just polaxed.
Oh, he did.
Absolutely. there was nothing left of the Junior Johnson car. But little Bud's car wasn't that badly damaged.
That was that old 63 Louis Weathersby Plymouth. That old yellow Plymouth. I think she was
an ex-Petty Plymouth, probably.
Yeah, I think it was.
I remember that. I was looking right at that wreck. Junior spun out all by himself and was sitting there in the sort of still in the groove, and boy, little Bud, his helmet must have spun around in front of his eyes. Remember, he didn't have it. He didn't have her latched on too good.
But little Bud would tell that story. It would be enough to keep you in the floor laughing, I tell you what.
He put that Junior to Holly Farms car out of her misery that day. Speaking of little Bud Moore, we did lose him a couple of weeks ago, a month ago, and we're going to have a little tribute race for him this Saturday night at Lakeview Speedway. It's opening up on a very rare occasion. They've been closed this whole year, and they're going to open this one time, and that may or may not be the end of everything for them. We don't know, but we're going, and we're going to, our race is the little Bud Moore Vintage Memorial Classic in his honor, and his family is coming. His wife.
Quick question, Robert. When I get off of 95 on to number 9, do I just stay on number 9 to get to the track?
Yes.
Till you get to, what is it, Racetrack Road?
You will go on through. When you get off of 95 there at Dillon, I guess.
Yeah.
It's about 13 miles.
Down number nine, and you.
If you look close, there he is.
If he's coming from that direction, he will be able to see the sign, and it's a right turn off of 9.
Yeah, just sort of pay attention. You will go on through the little town of Lakeview, Tim. You go through that, and you get to go in again, sort of out through the country, and it will be a right turn. And the name of the road is Racetrack Road.
Well, remember, I can't see very well, and it's my right eye that is the blindest. So,
bring a spotter.
Yeah, I'll be riding around. Just look for the silver mercury.
Bring a spotter.
Yeah, I need a spotter.
So we got that going on for the,
that sounds good,
commemorate
man.
The occasion.
Yeah,
however,
that's great.
You know, maybe it'll turn out, hopefully. But that was a little Bud Moore type of place. Lakeview is where he come from, that sort of setting.
And that's slated to be the only race that they have at Lakeview Speedway this year.
Maybe forever.
The future of that track is very much in doubt.
Yeah. Why is that, Hugh?
It's for sale.
They want too much for it.
And in our opinion, they're asking too much for it, and therefore it's not been sold, it's not been leased, and it's not been raced on this year. They had a practice last month, a one Saturday afternoon practice.
They have to have a paying race at least once a year in order to keep all their various
permits,
grandfathering, etc. And that's what this race is all about. So we're just hoping, and this is just purely a hope, that it just leads to something else. So we're going to try to just help the effort.
That's a great track. When I came over there a few years ago to watch you guys race, it is a great track.
Yeah, it's a classic little dirt track, and maybe, you know, maybe something will happen.
Maybe somebody will come that's interested enough to do something with it.
It could be, if there was some negotiation that could go on the price structure, I think it would already have been.
Yeah,
probably.
That kind of, there have been some inquiries, I know, but everything that we've heard has come back to the fact that he wants too much for it, and he has not been willing to negotiate down to anybody else's price range.
So anyway, we'll just see how that works out. So keep your fingers crossed.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, Hugh, take it out, man. What do you got?
I miss Benny Parsons.
I do too.
I just wrote that a while ago that when you stop and think about, at our age, all of the racers that have gone, Bobby was talking about little Bud Moore and on and on and on, some real fine, upstanding gentlemen, as well as good racers. And it's kind of sad to see that generation of racer aging out, some of them passing away. You see what's there now, and nothing against them, but they're not the same kind of racers, and they're not the same kind of competitors, nor are they the same kind of gentlemen that we had 25 years ago. That could be a good thing or a bad thing. Personally, I miss the old guys, but maybe it's because I'm an old guy too. Jeff's over here shaking his head, uh-huh. I think we ought to let Alex tell us about his new job.
Yeah, Alex, get Alex on the line. Hey, cut me out and bring Alex on and let him talk about his job.
How am I going to do that? Alex, call the studio, 843-272-1900.
I think that's a really big deal.
Here, I love the way you said to where I was hearing this, how am I going to do that? If I had the answer to that, I'd go to the White House and tell Trump, out, I'm running this country.
Yeah, don't run him out before he nukes
and
Kim Jong-un.
Obviously, you don't.
No, my technical knowledge is so far in the history books, you know, I'm still fighting with flintlocks.
Listen, you can do Skype, and I don't even know what that word is.
Here's some Darlington trip. Track was measured to be 1.375 miles in 1953.
Huh.
Then was reconfigured to be 1.366 miles following the spring race in 1970.
Alex made a comment on the chat line that the 1.25 was merely a screw-up. So
could have been.
Now, you know that never happens in NASCAR. Oh, that's totally
well, that
impossible.
Wouldn't have been NASCAR. That would have been Brazington.
Oh.
So, Alex, did they reconfigure the track or just remeasure it?
I think they just remeasured it. At the very least, it was definitely remeasurement when it went from 1.38 to the 1.366.
So tell us about your new job.
All right, so my new job is fairly basic at this stage. But the goal is to take all the weekly racing standings and stuff and digitize it.
Sweet.
Hey, cool.
Who for? For what? What? Who's doing that?
Doing the digitizing?
I mean, who are you working for?
It's NASCAR.
Oh, okay. So NASCAR's taking that on, really?
That's a huge step to me.
That's a great step.
To me, too.
Yeah. So the basics is we've got all the preview and press guides. Those have the whole history of every division, pretty much, that ran the weekly racing. And for every track, you have the annual standings and stuff, and just plug those all in and put them on the internet.
So
you'll be able to find your results, Jeff, or Tim's results, or Tim's brother.
So I hope that leads into doing late model sportsmen.
Late model sportsmen, we're going all the way back.
Perfect.
We're doing it all. We're doing the
awesome
weekly racing. We're doing the late model sportsmen, doing the hobby division.
Who is responsible for doing that? Whose idea was it? Because I want to go shake somebody's hand. That's been needed for a long time.
It was actually a project started by a guy at NASCAR.
Huh. Very, very cool, man. That's exciting news.
But, you know, I think it was Alex's persistence that really got it off the ground, because he picked up the ball and he didn't drop it.
Nice work, buddy.
And that's something that they have sorely needed for a long time and should have never let it fall by the wayside to start with. It's going to be really a challenge to go back and pick up all that information.
Well, it's going to be easier now than it would have been years ago, though, because of technology.
As long as
the
records.
Because the technology, it's harder, though, because I've got almost 70 years of results from over 200-plus, from 300-plus tracks.
But that is no mountain for a climber like you, man.
you're gonna do us proud. I can tell already.
Yeah, I'm already proud. I'm already proud. That is awesome, buddy. That's good news. Good to hear that. Good to hear that. All right, I'm going to get us out of here because I'm about to go to sleep, man.
Hey.
I've been in 4 days without any, hardly any sleep.
Thanks,
everybody, for what you did to contribute to this show. Alex, congratulations, man. Thanks for what you're doing there. That's really, really cool. Special thanks to all you folks that are listening to us out there. We appreciate that, both of you. And like I always say, a special thanks to the men and women in the military. Thank you for what you're doing. Everyone, have a good night and God bless.
Racing through history.
Welcome back, everyone, for another edition of Stars Radio, your short track auto racing source. A production of the Zeus Radio Network for Racers Reunion Radio. We've had a couple weeks off here, folks. The boss man was out of town 1 week, and the eclipse was pretty big down here in Columbia last week. Had a lot of traffic issues and everything, so we just went ahead and decided to skip the show last week because of everything going on down in our area here in Columbia, South Carolina. But we're back this